This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. As the devil is said to be capable of quoting scripture, he must be able to quote statistics to serve his needs as well. Well, today on the Afternoon Magazine, we're going to talk about damned lies and statistics with Joel Best. Joel Best is professor and chair of sociology and criminal justice at the University of Delaware. He's the author of two books about statistics for the lay reader. The first was Damned Lies and Statistics, Untangling Numbers from the Media, Politicians, and Activists. Now the sequel, More Damned Lies and Statistics, How Numbers Confuse Public Issues. Both books are published by the University of California Press. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for Joel Bass. Join the discussion with the telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If you're listening outside the Champaign-Urbana area, and if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL. In addition to his two books on numbers, Professor Best is also the author of Random Violence, How We Talk About New Crimes and New Victims, and Threatened Children, Rhetoric and Concern About Child Victims. Listeners, again, I look forward to your questions and comments about numbers for Joel Best. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Professor Best, thanks for joining us this afternoon. Welcome back to the program.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Well, here we are. We're just a few weeks now away from the election, and lots of information has come our way through the campaigns and the news media in an effort to inform us and persuade us. Observations here to start our conversation this afternoon about the quality of the numbers, the information that we've been showered with this election year?
Well, I think it varies. I think the key thing about the numbers we hear is, the key thing to remember is that people count. And what I mean by that is that every number has been produced by someone for some reason. Every number is the product of somebody counting something. And I think that sometimes we think of numbers as though they're little nuggets of truth, that, you know, you can pick them up just the way that a rock collector picks up a stone. But it's better to think about numbers as jewels. You know, you can pick up a gemstone, but it has to be cut and polished and placed in a setting to be viewed from a particular angle. And in much the same way, the numbers that we hear are all products of people's efforts, and they're carefully selected. So that if you listen to the vice presidential debate the other night, both candidates were throwing around numbers, and if you listen to NPR the next morning, you heard that both of them had chosen numbers that highlighted the case that they were trying to make. And I think that not just the numbers that the politicians offer us, but the polls that we hear and so on, they're all products of somebody trying to convince us of something. And we need to keep that in mind when we think about them.
Yeah. Gems, that's a nice way to think about it. And I guess that also explains why we're so fond of numbers. We like them, and they can support what we believe to be true. And so being human, we might not see a flaw or flaws.
Right,
those,
I think
in those gems,
we all had that third grade social studies unit called Facts and Opinions, and you know, you were supposed to sort out factual statements. There are 50 states from opinions. Citizen Kane is the greatest American movie, and I think that when you take the quiz, one of the cues you learn is that if the sentence has a number in it, it's going to be a fact. And I think a lot of us have carried that sort of uncritical assumption that numbers are factual around with us. They're very comforting because it seems like it's real. It's more than just an opinion. But, of course, every number is a product of a whole series of choices. Somebody decided to count something, and they decided to count it in a particular way, and they decided what was going to count and so on. And all of that shapes the result, and you can't ever forget that.
Yeah. Well, numbers can be used to comfort us. They can also be used to scare us.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I think that the standard way to arouse public concern about some social problem is to offer a kind of three-part recipe. And the first part of the recipe is that you tell the most terrible story in the world, you know, some kind of atrocity tale. The worst possible case is used as an example. And the second part is that you then say, this is an example of the X problem, and you give the problem a name, the missing children problem or whatever. And then finally, you couple it with a statistic, and the statistic is the biggest number you can imagine, and it's intended to make us think, good grief, this is a huge problem, and that is very frightening for us.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, who doesn't appreciate a little drama, right?
Exactly.
But, you know, we say to ourselves and we say to one another, expect the best, prepare for the worst. But here in this chapter that you've written for More Damned Lies and Statistics, Scary Numbers, the chapter, mm-hmm. you say, you know, it seems we're ready to think that things are much worse than they are. What's behind that tendency to think that things are worse than they are?
There's a mathematician named John Allen Paulus who coined the term innumeracy, and it's sort of the mathematical equivalent of illiteracy. It's not being completely comfortable with numbers, and we're all innumerate to some degree or other. Everyone has this problem. We hear a big number, and we find ourselves thinking, good grief, that's a sign that this is a really big problem. And we don't really stop to think about this very hard. An example that I use in the first book is that, and I've seen this on many term papers that I've graded, there was a number floating around for a number of years that anorexia killed 150,000 people a year. And, you know, people think anorexia is a very serious illness. It can be fatal. Karen Carpenter died. It's a big problem. 150,000 is a big number. Sounds about right. And that number's been repeated in best-selling books and in countless magazine and newspaper articles, and you can find it on the Internet and so on. The problem with it is that, as we all know, most of the people who suffer from anorexia are young women. And so a reasonable question is, how many young women die? Well, if you take all the women aged 15 to 45, who would surely be most of the anorexic deaths from anorexia in any given year, all of the women who are killed from all causes, that is disease, homicide, suicide, accident, you know, everything, there are about 50,000 of them, 50,000 deaths each year. So what are the odds that 150,000 of those 50,000 die from anorexia?
It doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't make any sense at all. And nobody bothers to check that. I mean, the amazing thing is that number floated around, and it was in very wide circulation, and nobody bothered to check it because they were thinking, well, it's a big number, and it's a big problem. A big number equals a big problem. That must be about right. And we do this time and again with social problems.
Yeah, it surprised me here in this new book, the sequel. Mm-hmm. There's a chapter at the end about, you know, working toward number literacy,
mm-hmm.
and it surprised me here that statistics courses, I never took one, focus on calculation, and that makes mm-hmm. a lot of sense. But next to nothing about interpreting or about peeling back. You know, looking at methodology and, you know, how the number was produced and how it's interpreted.
That's right. Statistics is taught primarily by math teachers, and they teach it as a mathematics course. And if anyone who's taken a statistics class knows that you start off with the instructor describing statistic A and what is the problem that statistic A addresses, and how do you calculate statistic A, and how should you think about it when you when you get the statistic, and then you move on as soon as you've mastered that to statistic B, which is even more complicated, and you march right through the semester or the year doing that. And what is missing from that is any sense that there's a social process by which numbers are produced. That is, these numbers are, if you'll excuse a bit of jargon, socially constructed. And we concentrate on the calculation of statistics, but we don't think very much about the construction of statistics. And that's also part of thinking critically about numbers, I think.
Why do you suppose this is the case, that we don't think much about interpretation?
Well, I think that it immediately moves out of the mathematical realm. And I think that the teachers and the textbook authors aren't as comfortable thinking about those issues. And, you know, the great thing about a math class is they're right answers. that's one of the comforting things. But once you start thinking about, well, how should you define missing children? You know, what is the correct definition of missing children? You know, reasonable people can disagree. Some people are going to want to have a very broad definition, and some people may want to have a narrower definition. And if you have a broad definition, you'll get a big number, and if you have a narrow definition, you'll get a little one. And, you know, we're not in the realm of mathematics anymore, and I think that that just seems too messy and confusing. And besides that, we've got this harder statistic C that we need to deal with. Maybe we ought to get on with that.
So really, this business of looking at how we interpret statistics, how we interpret numbers, really is a topic for social science courses.
Well, you'd like to think so. I mean, I'm a sociologist, and I certainly think that sociology has a lot to offer here. I think that there are probably other disciplines as well. But, of course, the problem is that the social scientists don't want to really be responsible for this either. Most sociology departments offer a statistics class, but like every other statistics class, it becomes a class in calculation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Quantitative analysis in XYZ. Joel Best is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. He's professor and chair of sociology and criminal justice at the University of Delaware. He's the author of a couple books now about statistics for general readers. The first was Damned Lies and Statistics, Untangling Numbers from the Media, Politicians, and Activists. Now the sequel, More Damned Lies and Statistics, How Numbers Confuse Public Issues. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn, and I invite you to join the discussion. And join us with questions, comments for Joel Best, our guest this afternoon. Give us a call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with some listeners. First, we go to Chicago, a caller on line 4. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi. I have a comment and a question. Usually, my experience is that interpretation of statistics is covered in research methods, and that's usually a graduate course, and I'm not sure everyone who does research methods who teaches it actually understands interpretation of statistics. So probably the degree to which you're going to get that covered depends on the instructor. And the second question I have is something that I never understand, and I've heard a lot of these polls on public opinion, and they're always based on a sample of like 1,000 or more. Mm-hmm. And it has boggled my mind that they think they can get the American opinion based on what might be the population of a middle school in terms of size. And so I'm sure that there must be some mathematical explanation why they think that 1,000 can substitute for the whole. So if you could explain to me why I'm supposed to believe these polls when they give me the sample size and it's 1,000 or less.
Good question.
Okay, well, let's take the two parts in turn. I think that you're right. If you take advanced graduate methodology course, you are going to spend some time thinking about interpreting numbers. But that isn't really what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is picking up your newspaper and reading a story that says there are 2 million missing children, or some other number of that sort, and we need to be asking ourselves, where'd that number come from? What's a missing child? What counts? Who's counting? Why are they counting? And that's not really what the graduate course is dealing with. That's kind of basic critical thinking that we should all have a little familiarity with. Now, the sample size question is, this is a problem that bothers a lot of people, and in a sense, it is, it's not something that you have to worry about. There are mathematical principles, which I doubt very much that I can explain without a blackboard, and radio is not the best medium for trying to work with a blackboard. But the basic idea is that if you have drawn a truly random sample, you can estimate public opinion or whatever in a very large population with a fair degree of accuracy, and that degree of accuracy is usually covered when the anchor person says plus or minus 3% or whatever. That's not really the problem. The real problem is getting a random sample. If you have a good representative, that is usually a random sample of the population, you're well on your way to having an accurate or a reasonably accurate finding. The real problem is that samples tend to be biased because random samples are very expensive to draw. And so typically people compromise, and they compromise in lots of different ways. And it's getting harder and harder to get random samples. One of the things that's bothering pollsters, for example, is that an increasing proportion of the population are filtering their phone calls through some sort of caller ID or something of that sort, and they aren't answering their phone. They don't want to answer the pollster's questions. And to the degree that the people who refuse to pick up are different from those who answer, the results of the survey may be disrupted. So it's really not the sample size that's the problem. 1,000 people will actually give you a pretty good estimate for the national population. What's really the question is, can you get a representative, a random sample? And that's much harder to do.
Okay, listener, did you want to...
The problem, because if you are depending on people with phones, you've already eliminated all of the homeless.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And the other problem is that this country is so vast, and we have so many geographical differences, that if you limit your random sample to one area, you already don't have a random sample of the entire United
mm-hmm.
States.
No, that's... I mean, I don't think
it's ever possible to get a random sample.
Right.
I don't think it's getting harder. I think that's an illusion.
Well, you're right. It is very, very difficult to do this. And you are always going to fall short of perfection. And what you're trying to do is fall less short of perfection than you might otherwise do. But in general, polls are accurate within the standard error. I mean, this information is not completely useless or completely wrong or whatever. The famous example of the poll being wrong was the Literary Digest poll in 1932 or 36, I've forgotten which, that predicted that Franklin Roosevelt's opponent was going to win. And that, people look back on that now and they say, well, we know why that was wrong. They were sampling phone books, and only a very small proportion of the population had phones. Today, a much larger proportion of the population has phones. And that used to be a reasonable way to get people, but more and more people aren't answering.
Okay. I want to thank the listener for her call this afternoon. I've got some other folks waiting for us, so let's go on to another listener in Indiana on line one. Hi.
Oh, I guess right off the bat, I'm surprised you didn't use the Dewey-Truman thing, because in terms of the larger part of the population now, they would certainly look at that one. The statistical evidence was similar to the Literary Digest, though I knew about that. Two questions. One is, I often hear the expression hard statistics, and I just sort of wondered if that is something that's actually well-defined within statistics and what you're interested in the sociology of it. And the second question, I guess, I know about the probability stuff in mathematics, but the other thing you say sometimes may make people sort of scratch their head. You say, well, 1,000 people, they're well, if it's a well-done study and the people are actually random, it will take in the entire United States. Now, just how do you get a hold of approximately 200 million people after you do 1,000 people to get their viewpoint on it? Or is it from past experience, like at an election where 1,000 people said it would be this way and it went 51-49, and later on when the actual vote was, it was like 51.7, you know, to 48.6 or something like that? I wish you'd explain that.
Well, okay, once again, the blackboard shortage isn't going to make things any easier, but basically this is based upon it's not some retrospective thing. It's based on mathematical theory. That is, what you're able to do is you basically imagine that you are you draw all the samples of 1,000 people that you'd like, and there would be a distribution of their scores around whatever the real value is for the public opinion, the candidate being favored or whatever. And you can say that 95% or 67% or whatever you choose of the scores will fall within a particular range, so that there's a 95 or 67% chance that whatever poll you've just done falls within that range. Right? That's the logic of it. It's a mathematical process, and it's actually reasonably accurate in practice. But we don't have a complete up-to-date list, you know, which of course would change second by second for the population of the whole country. And, you know, it's impossible to draw, you know, random samples that are truly random. You inevitably make some kind of compromise. And there are various ways of doing this. One way of doing it is to set up a computer to a telephone and have the computer randomly select telephone numbers and just dial them. And you obviously get a lot of numbers that don't have anyone there or that are a business or whatever, but eventually you'll come up with you know, what is considered to be a random sample of the population.
Okay. And this idea of the caller mentioned hard statistics, is that sort of a version of hard, cold facts?
I think it's you know, I think that's mostly rhetoric. I mean, there are two senses in which statistics are hard. If you're studying it, it gets really hard. but the other thing is, people will say, "Well, I've got hard statistics, like I have firm evidence here." That means they've counted something. Okay, fine. What did they count? How did they count it? Why did they, you know, what did they choose to count, and so on and so forth? How many Iraqis have been trained so far? Well, it depends on what you count. You count people who have completed their training for the armed forces? If so, it's a very small number. Do you count everybody who has even started training for the police, the National Guard, or anything else? Then you can get a somewhat higher number, and so on.
Okay, let's talk with another listener, a caller on a cell phone, line 2. Are you there?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Well, I'm in the profession, as it were, and I guess I have a few observations. I'm really glad to hear the emphasis on looking past just the calculation, because although I've found in my experience students don't like to hear that, unfortunately, mm-hmm. they really want the cookbook. That's what they're looking for, and it's sad, but it's true. There are some statistics books written by people who really do focus on this issue. There's some statisticians from Berkeley, David Friedman and his colleagues, and I can't remember their names off the top of my head, have written a very, very, very nice introductory statistics book called Statistics, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Which focuses very heavily on conceptual understanding and looking past the numbers, in addition to giving you a pretty thorough introduction to how to actually calculate what you need to calculate. I found that book quite useful. There's a few others that where people, the authors have really paid attention to this issue. Unfortunately, I think the topic is difficult enough that it takes a long time to get some maturity in it, and so, you know, one class is helpful, but it's not going to really give you the experience. I'll let you comment on that for the moment, and then I think I have another question.
Well, yeah, I actually am not really interested in the statistics that are taught in college classes or whatever. I mean, I think that the people who, I don't teach those courses, and I think the people who do teach them are much better qualified to judge how they ought to be taught. My point is that the numbers that we run into in everyday life, when we pick up the newspaper, when we hear a radio or television broadcast, when we read a magazine article, we're bombarded with numbers. It is important, I think, that people approach those numbers with a certain amount of critical thinking. And it's not so much the sophisticated understanding about, you know, how do you, you know, what should you watch for when you're interpreting some table with multivariate regression results. That's for a very tiny proportion of the population. But we are all being asked to worry about the crime rate. We're all being asked to, we're all being told that there are dangers in secondhand smoke. We're all being asked to believe that college rankings mean something, and so on and so forth. And I think that people can understand how those numbers are produced, and they can learn to recognize some basic warning signs, things to watch out for.
I totally agree. I didn't mean to imply that you had to become an expert statistician to interpret anything. I do think, however, that, I mean, in a sense, the boundary of mathematical statistics kind of, I may be overstating this a little bit, but kind of presumes that valid data have been gathered.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that, many a statistician, when consulting with clients, will say, "My God, I wish you talked to me before you went and gathered the data. I could have helped you.
Right.
I could have done something for you, but now it's too late." It is sort of conventional wisdom in the profession to realize that, you know, if the design is messed up, if the data are dubious, there's very little that can be done subsequently to actually make the situation any better.
That's right. But I think that the people, the politicians, the activists, the newscasters, and so on, who are feeding us these numbers, I think oftentimes are not themselves aware of the limitations.
I've certainly noticed that.
Yeah, and as a result, they often have a kind of fervent conviction that what they're saying is true. And if you examine the numbers behind the claims, it's just impossible. I don't think that anybody deliberately set out to pass false anorexia statistics. I don't think that anybody was intentionally trying to lie or dissemble. But that number popped into being. And once it was there, it was repeated. And my sense is that a bad number is harder to kill than a vampire.
Hmm. I want to thank the caller for his question and comments this afternoon. And we're going to go to another listener who's waiting on a cell phone, line one. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I can't hear you, but I can assume that you can hear me. I think that the question that is asked is far more important than the statistics that come out of the question. I think that knowing the right questions and is far more important.
No, I agree.
And I think a lot of people are spending a lot of time in their minds on worrying about how to do the statistical evaluation when they really ought to know what questions were asked. And secondly, I think that people do use statistics knowing full well what they're doing. I think they ask the questions knowing the answers they're going to get to support their already predetermined conclusion. I think they use it for their own advantage, and I think they do it frequently.
I think they do it. I think we are all fond of numbers that support what we believe in. When I did the first book, I talked to different groups, and I was on radio shows and so on, and I was on shows with conservative hosts and with liberal hosts, and I found that the conservative hosts were quite eager to talk about those bad statistics that liberals circulate, and the liberals were quite eager to talk about the bad statistics promoted by conservatives. And we all become kind of analytic tigers when confronted with numbers from people we disagree with. All of a sudden, we're alert. You know, we are aware of the problems with sampling, the questionable definitions, the dubious assumptions, and so on and so forth. When we find numbers that fit our own predispositions, we tend to be much more forgiving. There may be some problems there, but after all, this is more or less what you'd expect to see. This seems to be about right. You're never going to get the figures perfect, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that, there's obviously a dimension of dishonesty here. There are people who take numbers that they know full well are bogus and circulate them. But I think probably a larger share of bad numbers come from people who are looking to support a case, find something, think this is the best number I've got, and I'm going to go with it. I think misplaced enthusiasm is to blame more than outright fraud.
And I think the listener is gone. So I want to thank him for his call this afternoon and invite others to join us. If you've got questions or comments, give us a call. Joel Best is our guest this afternoon, professor and chair of sociology and criminal justice at the University of Delaware. He's the author of a couple of books about statistics for us general readers. The first was Damned Lies and Statistics, Untangling Numbers from the Media, Politicians, and Activists. Now a second book, More Damned Lies and Statistics, How Numbers Confuse Public Issues. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name's Celeste Quinn. 333-9455, the number if you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area and you'd like to join the discussion. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Well, we love numbers and we're bombarded with numbers, and you point out that the more numbers that we have available to us, the more likely that they'll be used to shore up all kinds of arguments, and the more they'll be spun. You want to give us a couple of examples?
Well, my favorite examples are actually what I call legendary numbers, which are numbers that sort of appear from nowhere, have no basis in fact, and circulate rather widely. Two or three years ago, it became not uncommon to hear the number of deaths from some cause compared to the number of deaths from caused by falling coconuts. And you know, if you look up falling coconuts on a newspaper index, you'll find that this would turn up, and people would say, "Well, yeah, this is a problem," but actually, there are more people killed by falling coconuts. And supposedly the number killed by falling coconuts each year was 150 people. And this number circulated all over the place. And you might ask yourself, gee, who keeps track of deaths from falling coconuts? I mean, we can all imagine coconut falls a long way. It's hard. It bonks you on the head. You know, could be fatal, I suppose. Who's counting that? And the answer is nobody. It was some number that got put into circulation. It was circulated most widely by a travel agency. I'm not sure why they thought it would encourage people to travel. And other folks picked up on it. And you have similar kinds of stories. We've all heard that you need to drink 8 glasses of water a day. Well, that's true. You do need to take that much water in each day. But what isn't said there is that the largest share of that water is actually in the food. Meat or vegetables or bread or whatever contain a very large proportion of water. And you know, when people say you need 8 glasses of water a day,
they're not really talking about sitting down and chugging 8 glassfuls of water. They're, you know, just remarking that the body needs that much water, and you'll get, you know, you're almost certain to get that much water by just eating 3 meals a day.
Mm.
So there, you know, I'm really fond of these kind of legendary numbers that come from someplace, get misinterpreted, get repeated over and over again, become part of the common culture, and you know, no one can do anything about them. They're just with us.
Mm. A lot or a little? How many? These are questions that we're really interested in having answered. But sometimes there's no definitive answer.
Mm-hmm.
Talk with us, if you would, about how you try to size up numbers that are estimates.
Well, I think the first thing to be alert for, the thing that really ought to send alarm bells ringing, is when you get a big round number. You know, there are 1 million cases of elder abuse each year. There are 2 million missing children, you know, and so on and so forth. You know, it's amazing how often nature produces apparently social problems in the form of big round numbers. And a big round number of that sort is, I think, an excellent clue that there's probably something amiss, you know, that this is a guess rather than something that somebody's actually counted. A second question, which is, I think, very important, is to ask yourself, how would you get that number? Okay?
Mm-hmm.
How would you find that out? You will sometimes see, for example, reports of the number of gay teen suicides. Okay? Now, right away, it's reasonable to ask the question, who counts gay teen suicides? Suicides are, of course, going to be listed on coroner certificates. You know, that's one of the possible causes of deaths, and we can imagine that appearing. But I don't think the coroner coroner certificates list sexual orientation. How could anybody know that number? And, you know, there are lots of similar questions that you can ask. If you say to yourself, who is counting that and how would they go about counting it, that's sometimes an excellent first step in figuring out that there's something wrong.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Hi. I have a comment and also a question. My comment is a personal one. I was a math science major. My question is, do you think illness or age contributes to problems with math? And I'll hang up and listen to your guest response off the air. Thank you.
Well, beats me. I think I seem to have more trouble reconciling my checkbook each month, so maybe there's something to that. But I don't know. I don't know. There may be research on that. It's just something I don't know about.
Let's talk with another caller in Urbana, line two. Hi.
Yeah, I was wondering if your guests would talk about numbers given out by the Department of Justice in particular. I remember reading a number that, I don't know, was about 8 years ago, maybe a little bit less, that I was reading along in this publication of the Department of Justice, and it said something like 75% of Hispanics know at least one person involved in drugs or something like that.
Goodness.
And I had the same kind of reaction that you're talking about. I was thinking, now how would they know that, you know? And if you did that to other groups, I wonder what the percentage would be and blah, 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 because it was just by itself in the middle of a paragraph with nothing else, you know, to support it. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about numbers coming out of the Department of Justice, and if you see that some of them are particularly biased and skewed, and et cetera. And I'll hang up. Thanks.
Well, I think that the reaction that you described is exactly the right reaction. That is, when you see a number like that, you start thinking, how would you measure that? Do you do a sample of, you know, do a survey of Hispanics and ask them if they know anyone who's involved with drugs? I suppose you could. I've never seen numbers like that. It's kind of hard to imagine who's going to do that survey and how they're going to go about doing it. So I have no idea what the basis for that number is. I think that government statistics depend a great deal on the nature of what is being counted. The government is certainly the largest organization that collects statistics, and they spend lots and lots of money, doing different kinds of research, from the census to the monthly unemployment figures and so on and so forth. And oftentimes these numbers are the product of a great deal of thought and a great deal of arguing about how best to count things. So, for example, you get a count that comes out periodically about how many poor people there are in the United States, the so-called poverty rate. And people argue about how the poverty rate ought to be calculated. And you will find people, usually conservatives, who argue that the definition for being poor ought to be set higher so that fewer people get counted as poor. And oftentimes liberals will argue, no, the bar is too high, it ought to be lowered, and in fact the real number should be somewhat greater. Now, there are whole books written about how to calculate the poverty rate, and people argue about this. They debate it. The good news is that we at least know how the government does this. I mean, this is a very public process, and you can disagree. And sometimes you'll see people estimating what the real poverty rate would be if you would define it differently, and so on and so forth. Where there are different groups, competing groups, trying to have input on how something is defined, you tend to get pretty good numbers coming out of the government. They may not be the numbers that you think. Things may not be counted quite the way that you think they ought to be counted, but at least you can be fairly confident that the numbers are plausible. Other kinds of numbers really aren't worth very much. The methodology is too shaky. We've been collecting hate crime statistics for about 10, 15 years, and it's probably going to be quite a while before hate crime statistics are good enough so that you can have much confidence in them. I think that which numbers, it isn't that the Justice Department has all good numbers or all bad numbers. Some of their numbers are going to be better established, more carefully gathered than others. And that's going to be true for every agency of the federal government.
Let's get in one more caller this afternoon in Danville, line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Your discussion calls to mind the motto of a friend of mine's father, which is figures never lie, but liars often figure. I often wonder about figures that are thrown about by organizations such as World Health Organization that predict that there will be 250 million people will have AIDS by the end of the next decade, and those numbers are obviously extrapolated. And if you have any comment about that.
Well, obviously, it's hard to count things that are here right now. It's hard to count things that are in the past, and it is especially tricky to count things in the future. And we do it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
We make estimates. And of course, when you're estimating what the federal deficit is going to be or what the population of the earth is going to be or how many people are going to have AIDS going into the future, you have to make certain assumptions about how things are going to change. And you could be, your assumptions could be wrong. They could be, too favorable or too unfavorable to whatever you're counting. And we can't get along without statistics. We live in a complicated world. And we need numbers to help us get a grip on the overall patterns, including, best guesses for the future. But obviously, statistics about the future are uncertain. And we need to be very, very careful. We can't just take those things on faith and assume they're completely accurate.
Yeah. But that's another thing we love about numbers. They help us cope with uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. They were there. We have to leave it. We're out of time.
Well, thank you so much, Celeste.
Oh, my pleasure. Good to talk with you again. Joel right. Best has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of a couple of books about numbers for general readers, for the lay public. The first was Damned Lies and Statistics, Untangling Numbers from the Media, Politicians, and Activists. Now the sequel, More Damned Lies and Statistics, How Numbers Confuse Public Issues. Both books are published by the University of California Press. Joel Best is professor and chair of sociology and criminal justice at the University of Delaware.